Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Another edition of the Fiscal Cliff Time Machine coming up on the broadcast today, everybody. Finding the melody in the markets and what happens when an entire industry dies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for December the 5th, 2012. It is a Wednesday, and it is good to have you here. There was more tit-for-tatting over the fiscal cliff today. The president said something. The speaker said something else. The details aren't all that important because, really, we've heard it all before. I can say that because it's true. We featured the president yesterday on our game show, The Fiscal Cliff Time Machine. Today's installment, Speaker of the House John Boehner. We're going to play two pieces of tape. You remember how it goes. One is him last year talking about the debt limit fight. The other is this year talking about the fiscal cliff. And your job, if you recall, is to figure out which one is this year. So here we go. You ready? Is it choice number one?
There is no agreement. There's no deal in private.
Or choice number two?
Right now, I would say we're nowhere. Period. We're nowhere.
All right, those cuts are pretty short. We're going to play them again. You ready? Here you go. First one.
There is no agreement. There's no deal in private.
And the second.
Right now, I would say we're nowhere. Period. We're nowhere.
So, which one is this year? You can tell us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceAPM. The answer to yesterday's quiz, by the way, coming up at the end of the broadcast. You got to stick around. All right, moving on now to other news. The British are leaving. The British are leaving. It looks like Tesco, the British supermarket giant, is going to pack up and go home. Tesco's fresh and easy neighborhood markets have apparently become more like stale and complicated. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has the story.
5 years ago, when Tesco announced it would bring cheap, fresh food to urban neighborhoods in America, British retail analyst Robert Clark told us Tesco had figured out what was missing in our marketplace.
You have your big superstores, your major grocery stores, and you have your smaller local stores, but there's actually not a lot in between.
But Fresh and Easy's in-between never really caught on. Didn't help that they chose to open in California, Nevada, and Arizona just as their housing markets went bust. But even the store's fans, like Malu Villagonzalo, couldn't quite define what Fresh and Easy was when we met her shopping at one this morning in L.A.
This is like the closest, almost like grocery store type of, and they have like food that I could eat during lunchtime.
International marketing consultant Allison Stewart Allen blames everything from bad store lighting to self-service checkout for the store's failure. And then there's the fruit and veggies.
They pre-packed the produce. And anyone that knows the American culture well will know that Americans want to choose their own grapefruit and apples and fresh items rather than have those selections edited for them.
When Tesco entered the American market in 2007, some analysts considered it Walmart's worst nightmare. Now, says Stewart Allen, Walmart is a potential buyer of Tesco's 199 American stores. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
From the coffee mecca that is Seattle today, this news, just when you thought they couldn't cram another Starbucks into your neighborhood, they're gonna. At least 1,500 new cafes in the U.S. over the next 5 years. And when there are already so many of them, deciding where to put the new ones is the art of the deal, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Starbucks made its expansion plans public at an investors' meeting today. Executives admitted the growth of new stores in the past was, quote, undisciplined. Many stores cannibalized each other. Some had to be closed. But a Starbucks spokesman told me this time they'll follow their customers, not just build new cafes willy-nilly.
Food service chains are looking for traffic.
Sarah Johnson is an economist at IHS.
So they want to be on heavily traveled streets, places where people can conveniently stop.
Starbucks is planning more drive-thrus and grocery store kiosks. The idea is if you make it that convenient, you'll get impulse buys from people who normally wouldn't spring for an expensive cup of joe. Ken Perkins is president of Retail Metrics. He says it works. In fact, he gets sucked into a kiosk for Starbucks rival Dunkin' Donuts every time he goes grocery shopping.
And there's always a line, so it's not just me.
Retailers are also invading college campuses. Starbucks says it'll follow that trend, too, although it may have a harder sell with the hipster crowd. I meet 23-year-old Julian Flamont walking down K Street in downtown Washington.
They have to be careful of where they go because they're not very hip. You know, they're kind of corporate.
Flamont is holding a cup of coffee. It's not from Starbucks. He avoids Starbucks if he can, but he's always ready for a jolt of caffeine. And if there were a Starbucks in his grocery store, he'd belly right up to the coffee bar, hip or not. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Split decision today at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan. Two up, one down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Financial markets, as you know, move in mysterious ways. They often lack rhyme or reason. If you look hard enough, though, they might just have a melody. A British academic and a banker over there think so. And to prove their point, they've just produced an opera called Open Outcry. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This is an opera without a plot. There are no heroes or villains. It revolves around one simple idea, that somewhere in all this, there is harmony. Oi! Oi! Commodity traders in full cry. To most, this will sound like a horrible cacophony, but not to Greg Davies, a senior banker with Barclays. To his ear, it's almost music.
Music is about expressing emotion. Music is about expressing our feelings and our responses to the world.
And what could be more emotional than face-to-face trading? Greg helped produce Open Outcry, the opera. The work was devised by a computer music specialist from Plymouth University, Alexis Kirk.
So I thought, well, what if you took the Open Outcry trading floor and instead of shouting, they were singing, so they were projecting what they wanted through the singing voice.
Twelve singers, all dressed in brightly coloured jackets, gesticulate and sing their trades. They're dealing in three desirable commodities: wealth, protection and comfort.
Buy to protection, 8-5, buy to...
But Alexis Kirk says this is not as airy-fairy as it sounds. The singers are interacting with a computer model programmed to soar and plunge. At the end of the evening, the singers' trades are totted up, and they get paid accordingly.
So this is a real story. This is a story of real passions, real frustration, real gains and real losses with money.
Which might explain why at one point the singers stop singing and resort to shouting instead. With several hundred dollars at stake, singers Joe Reynolds and Paul Kayang admit it was a nerve-wracking experience.
Yeah, it was quite exciting and quite confusing and pretty scary.
I spent much of the gig in a state of panic and terror. So
just like a real market, then.
I fear that might be the way it goes, actually.
Open Outcry is not Mozart. It's not even Gilbert and Sullivan. It's offbeat, experimental, a little baffling. So why precisely did Barclays Bank get involved?
Well, for Barclays, it's about associating finance with something creative, with something artistic, with something novel.
Something less creative than the rigging of the LIBOR interest rate and less dramatic than the subprime crisis. But this odd little opera is at least a brave attempt to bring harmony out of financial discord. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Buy to protection, 8-5, buy to protection, 8-5.
Okay, that's a little weird, right? Listening to too much of that? Anyway, music fans, get your DVRs ready. The Grammy nominations concert is tonight. And for the first time in as long as most can remember, it's not going to be held here in L.A. It's up and moved to Nashville, Tennessee, Music City, USA. Carl Dean is the mayor there. Mr. Mayor, it's good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you.
It's quite the coup to get this concert. Was there some arm twisting going on?
Well, I've made it known for some time that I was interested in seeing the Grammys have a presence in Nashville, be it through the nomination show or through the show itself. So it just seemed to be a natural that a show would take place in Nashville, Tennessee.
Are you guys consciously broadening your base, not necessarily away from country music, but you want the rise of the rest? You want the hip-hoppers and the rappers and the rockers and everybody, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the city is an organized effort necessarily to organize the diversity of the music. It's just happening.
What was it like 3-4 years ago, Mr. Mayor? I mean, how did you guys do in the recession? You know, because you're coming out of it now, obviously. But what was it like for you then?
Well, Nashville has a diverse economy. If you looked at the city in terms of our economic base, our number one employer is healthcare. I mean, Nashville is a city that is probably the healthcare management center of the United States, if not the world. And then you have hospitality, which employs about 53,000 people. And we have a lot of visitors to our city who come for music, who come because of the natural beauty of the area. And then Nashville is a major university city. So those things have really given us a diverse economy that has made it possible for us to get through the recession probably a little bit better than most places, but we certainly felt it.
Do you watch that show, Nashville?
I certainly do. There's a great subplot in it about a mayoral election.
I know.
Their campaign is a little more interesting than mine was.
There's some skullduggery, right?
There's some skullduggery that didn't take place in any of my races, but I enjoy the show. And again, you look at the show, and it's filmed here in Nashville. The city looks great, and the name Nashville is all around the country and in the world.
This is kind of sideways, but can you be the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee, without having a really good sense of music?
Well, I love music and go to a lot of concerts, but I have no musical talent.
All right.
And so you can.
All right. Fair enough. Carl Dean, he's the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee. The Grammy nominations concert is there tonight. Mr. Mayor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
For example, in 2005, the Eastman Kodak Company was ahead of Apple on the Fortune 500 list.
My, how times change. The end of analog photography coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so it was a good day for Wall Street unless you rely too heavily on Apple. We'll get there in just a sec. The Dow Industrials bumped up 82.6%, finished at 13,034. The NASDAQ powered down 22.75%, 2973. The S&P 500 up 2 points, 0.1%, ended at 1409. So here's the deal with Apple. Sliced off nearly 6.5% today, its biggest loss in almost 4 years. One reason is that an analyst forecast said Apple is eventually going to lose its big share of the tablet market. Citigroup gained more than 6% on news it's going to lay off 11,000 employees worldwide. That's kind of the way the markets work. Bank of America added 5.5% today. Morgan Stanley up more than 2%. The Travelers popped up almost 5%. Insurance company said it's going to resume dividend payments to shareholders and that losses from Hurricane Sandy were on the low end of expectations. Pandora Media shuffled down 17.5%. The internet radio company said fourth quarter losses are going to be a lot bigger than analysts had projected. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama continue a 90-year tradition. They'll light the national Christmas tree. On Capitol Hill, Congress's Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing to discuss the fiscal cliff. And for all you busy people out there, here's a day for you. Tomorrow is Microwave Oven Day. Go heat something up. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay, so why is it that in an age where our cell phones can do almost anything, from music to pictures to, you know, actual calls, cell phone companies still insist on sending us bills that are all but indecipherable? AT&T seems finally to have gotten the message on that. The company is going to make its monthly statements available in another format, videos, customized for every customer. Gimmick or good business? Marketplace's David Gura reports.
If you need an accountant to make sense of your cell phone bill, you're not alone. Joan Engerbretson runs Telecompetitor, a website that focuses on the telecom industry.
Even I don't understand some of the things on my bill.
AT&T didn't get back to us, but Weston Hendrick with Current Analysis says this is what the company is finally acknowledging. Wireless statements are too complicated, which brings us to the video bill.
If a customer can hear it explained via voice.
Thanks for choosing AT&T, Brian. This video explains the key elements of your bill and is complimentary to you.
It's going to be easier for them to understand, or at least the perception will be that it's easier to understand.
Hendrick says smartphones have made wireless statements even harder to figure out.
Trying to understand what a megabyte is, what a kilobyte is, what a gigabyte is. You know, customers know they're using data, but it's difficult to understand exactly how that's billed for.
That's especially true if you have more than one phone line. James Breen is a senior analyst with William Blair & Company. A video bill could come in handy if mom, dad, and the kids are all on one statement.
And you do get that occasional, you know, $400 bill. It'll make it easier to figure out who the culprit is on the family side.
Breen says the video bill is part of a trend. Consumers don't want to have to figure something out. Why follow a recipe when there's a YouTube of someone baking?
Instead of having to read how to cook the cake, they actually show you how to do it.
If this technology works for cell phone bills, it may have other applications. The only thing more inscrutable than a wireless statement is a doctor's bill. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The oil fields of North Dakota are a man's world, as is true in most any mining rush. At the end of the day, they crowd into sprawling camps or rented basements where they sleep in their cars. Not too many wives out there with their husbands. We've been airing a series called Black Gold Boom out of Williston, North Dakota. Portraits of people caught up in the middle of that rush. Today, independent producer Laura Candler visits a woman who did follow her husband.
It's just cramped. There's no other way to put it but just really crammed. We're, you know, family of six, soon to be seven, stuck in a 12 by 56 foot house. I'm Shannon Atwell, stay-at-home mom. My husband's been here almost 2 years, and me and the kids have been here for just over a year. Construction was getting really bad in Kansas City, so we decided to be proactive before it got too rough and decided to come out here and check it out and try out the oil boom thing. Right at the moment, we're living in what's called a skid house, which is basically a camper slash trailer that they move around to the rig sites, and it's positioned on a salt water well right now. We can't drink our water in the house. We have to have bottled water. My kitchen, living room, dining room is within a 12 by 17 foot square, and it is three bedroom with one bath. It's a shower only, which is kind of difficult with little guys. You really do good to have a bathtub.
This is a better table.
It was pretty funny when we first got here. The boys were just like, oh, look, there's a semi. Oh, look, there's a backhoe. Now it's like, there's another semi. There's another backhoe. They've just gotten so used to the large equipment out here. They sometimes ask why we can't go back to our home in Missouri, and, you know, we just try to explain to them this is where Daddy's job is, and, you know, we want to be together as a family. So sometimes, too, they ask, you know, why we can't have a real house, and, you know, it's hard to explain to a kid that there just isn't housing up here. But after a year, I've gotten to know some of the other oil-filled wives, and it's getting better.
Someone's going to move in Kansas. All of us are going to live in Missouri.
I think, you know, in some ways it's cool that the boys are up here and it is such a male-dominated area, and we have some of the guys, you know, that are up here without their families come over and visit, and it's nice the boys are getting a little bit cultured. This economy right now, I really, with it being so bad, when I look out, sometimes I see all these truck drivers and stuff and think of how blessed all of us are up here that we have work, and we did upload our family and move 1,100 miles away on a let's pray this works and this is what we think we need to do. We went from a very nice home in Missouri that we just sold to this. Luckily, we're not living in a car or a man camp or anything, so we're doing pretty well.
You're right there, and you tell them what to do.
Black Gold Boom is an initiative of Localore and the Association of Independents in Radio. There's a little bit of a feud that's broken out online this week. Instagram, the photo sharing site that Facebook paid $1 billion to buy a couple of months ago, has decided it's not going to let its pictures show up on Twitter. There's a whole bunch of online he said, she said going on here. But the end result is something of a hiccup for online photo sharing and how we use and see photography. But let me take you back to an earlier time when you needed film and chemicals to see what you had. Analog photography is an industry that's all but dead. It's a demise that Robert Burley has spent the past few years documenting. His book is called The Disappearance of Darkness. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
It struck me probably the third or fourth time I flipped through this book that it's actually a book about infrastructure, right? It's about the infrastructure of analog photography.
Yes, it's what I've done over the last 6 years is I've been looking at the companies like Kodak and Polaroid that have supplied me with my most essential material, film, throughout my career. And during that time, of course, there's been very radical changes to photography and especially to these companies.
Yeah, it's the loss of a medium, yes, but also the loss of livelihoods too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the wonderful things about photography is it's a medium that everyone has a relationship to. But it's also been a very large business that has employed hundreds of thousands of people over the last century. And within the last decade, most of those jobs have been lost because it looks as though these companies really won't be able to adapt in the 21st century.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of physical destruction in this book. You took a lot of pictures of buildings being imploded, of manufacturing sites and treatment sites and office buildings just being blown up to get them out of there. And In many of them, there are people standing there watching. And I imagine that a lot of those people had worked in those buildings.
Yeah, I think for me, those were the most kind of poignant occasions that I photographed for this book. To go to Rochester, New York, which once employed one out of every four citizens in that city, and stand in front of these enormous structures, you know, that were usually at least a city block long and many stories high, and see them brought down within the space of less than a minute, it was a time when I just knew I was watching the end of an era.
You shot the pictures in this book on film. Obviously, 4x5 sort of medium format stuff.
That's right.
Are you going to go digital?
Well, I've already gone digital.
Have you? Kicking and screaming or no?
No, I think unless you live in a cave these days, it's impossible not to go digital. It's just so pervasive. But interestingly enough, when I started this project in 2005. There was no question about whether or not I would use film. But within a very short time period, and that's what's been so remarkable about this project for me, within a space of 6 years, this technological transition has happened and run full cycle. I would say it's pretty much over by now. If you think, for example, that in 2005, the Eastman Kodak Company was ahead of Apple on the Fortune 500 list, and that Facebook was a relatively new company that had just announced that 1 million subscribers. And everybody still had a film camera at that time. Mm-hmm. And everyone, I would say, probably had little boxes of Kodak film and Kodak prints in their household.
I have them in the bottom of my closet, yeah.
Well, but I would say they used to be out probably on your kitchen counter or, ready to use. And within that very short time span of a few years, all of that's disappeared. Kodak is now bankrupt and has recently announced that it will be selling off its still photography division. And Apple has created the device which is most popular for making photographs. And it's also a phone, by the way.
By the way, that's right. Robert Burley is a photographer. He teaches at the School of Image Arts at Ryerson University up in Toronto, Canada. His book is called The Disappearance of Darkness, Photography at the End of the Analog Era. Mr. Burley, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Well, shout out to Dave Brubeck there. I like that. This final note today, which I love, the history of AOL as told through New York Times crossword clues. The very first one, January 14th, 1997. Here you go. Prodigy competitor for shorts. February 26, 2002, it merged with Time Warner is another one. All the way down to December 5th last year, You've Got Mail Company. An engineer at Quartz, the Atlantic's new business site, built an app to let you search New York Times crosswords all the way back to 1996. I did, and sadly, I'm not there. Radio host, three letters. How hard can it be? Come on. All right, speaking of hard, here with the answer to yesterday's fiscal cliff time machine question. Remember, it was President Obama we were listening to. Clip number one was last year.
Let's ask the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations to give up some of their breaks in the tax code and special deductions.
Clip number two then was this year.
We'll have more time to work out a plan to bring down our deficits in a balanced way, including by asking the wealthiest Americans to pay a little more, so we can still invest in the things that make our nation strong.
Pretty similar, right? Congratulations to those who got it right. Tune in tomorrow for another round of Fiscal Cliff Time Machine. You can play today online at marketplace.org. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 82 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ powered down 22 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 up 2 points, about 0.1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And this, by the way, is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.